remaining 14 men, as he is the ranking Obergefreiter in our sector. Until the time comes for my guard duty, I sleep like a log. However, when Varias wakes me for my shift, I spring up and tear off like a caged animal which has just been freed. I am still half asleep, but it does prove to me that my nerves are not completely up to par. I am reminded, just as Meinhardt was when he came to us from Stalingrad. God, in the bunker area near Businovka, we were all so full of eagerness and the desire to win, and how impatiently we waited for the opportunity to fight at the front. Now, after exactly 3 weeks in combat, no one talks of heroism or enthusiasm anymore. On the contrary, the only wish is to get out of this death trap alive. This is not war as we imagined it would be, and of which we talked. As soldiers, you know that war also can mean death. But to talk about it without experiencing it is like talking about a house on fire without being in it. We have been in the fire for days and experienced the searing heat, and we have lost many of our comrades. 12th of December. When Wilke relieves me from guard duty early this morning, there is a pale red strip of light on the horizon to the east.
It will be a sunny day, says Wilke, and I agree.
Towards morning it always becomes colder, and I am thoroughly frozen and glad that there is heat in the bunker. Svina is leaning against the wall and is chewing on a piece of bread. Grommel is also awake and has kept the coffee warm for me, even though it came by an hour ago. After a long time without, we now receive a spoonful of marmalade with the square bread. Grommel is definitely a good friend, but I'm not sure that I can actually understand him. Is he really unable to shoot at the enemy? Why? It can't be because of fright, because during our counter-attacks he didn't hesitate to come with us. But that business yesterday about having his carbine with the safety catch on, when Weichert wanted to use it, that was bad. And it would have become even more obvious if the attackers had been any closer to us. He did make up for things, however, by clearing out the cartridges that had got stuck in the machine gun barrel. He is an expert at that. We often take minutes to remove a jammed cartridge, but it's no problem for him. That was vital yesterday, and Grommel was a great help. In the sky we see a twin-tailed German observation plane flying towards Stalingrad. He runs into a white cloud of anti-aircraft fire. Shortly afterwards he is shot down, leaving a dark smoke trail. Another aircraft flies low overhead and drops some supplies and ammunition boxes over the village. This evening we should be able to have some biscuits again. Apart from an hour of artillery fire, today must be considered a quiet one. Grommel, who knows every day of the week, tells us that it is Saturday. But what difference does the day of the week make? Today is almost like a holiday. How undemanding we have become. Just because the artillery has shelled us less than usual, we find it peaceful and manageable. But will it be like this tomorrow? We wish it could be. But wishes are like dreams. In reality, they melt like snow in the spring sunshine. Therefore, it will probably be a day like those before, with little hope and the unasked questions. Who will it be this time? Who will lie cold and stiff on the brutal and terrible Russian soil? Whose death will be witnessed and mourned by close friends? It's a good job no one knows in advance whether he is the next. For those who are hit, death always comes as a surprise, and much too early. And when it does come, we hope it will be over very quickly. Up till now, it was only our enemies who lay badly wounded along our front and whose cries I could hear. I often wake up at night thinking I can hear them moaning in the dark, with no one able to help them. God protect us from this terrible fate. 13th of December. I slept badly last night. When Grommel wants to wake me, I am already awake. I'm not at peace within myself, and I can't explain it. I have a gnawing sensation in my stomach, like an anthill. The cold outside is good for me. I meet Varias, who is on patrol in our sector. He tells me that the rumour is circulating that General Oberst Hort, with his tanks, is on the way to break open the pocket around Stalingrad. Is it true? Or is it as usual just gossip? Perhaps it really is the great salvation that all those who are surrounded are so fervently hoping for. But will it also do something for us here in our battered hedgehog position? Again, questions to which no one seems to have any answers. The wind suddenly carries sounds to us of a sort we've not heard before. They are a bit like trumpet blasts, repeated at various distances. Later, we hear the noise of powerful engines approaching through the night from the direction of Cheer. The trumpet sounds are new, and we can't make head nor tail of them. When I meet up with Meinhardt, he says that he has noticed searchlights being turned on over there now and then.
"Looks like he is assembling troops over there," he says to himself, and then adds, "Ivan is definitely up to something. If we only knew what."
The air around us becomes electric. The entire sector is now awake. Soldiers are emerging from the trenches and are walking nervously back and forth. Everyone is looking towards the front, but it is still too dark to make anything out. When I go to wake Weichert at 5 o'clock, he is already standing in front of the bunker, gazing towards Cheer. The nervous feeling in my stomach is now stronger. I remember that this same feeling of unease would also come to me at home, most often when I was about to start an important sports event. Here, however, it is much stronger. It is a concentrated excitement, brought about by the knowledge that something threatening is approaching, and we don't know what it is. A stifling situation. But we have to wait, wait until the grey of the morning. Little Grommel is the only one left in the bunker. I go inside to warm up my drink over the last bit of heat left in the oven. The drink is a leftover from the supply container dropped earlier. Grommel is sleeping, but his breathing is irregular. He is lying with his face towards the wall, and every so often his body gives a twitch. Just as I am about to pour my hot drink from my mess kit into my canteen cup, he suddenly leaps up with a yell and rushes, still half asleep, to the bunker entrance. I drop my cup in astonishment and grab him by the sleeve. He flails his arms wildly and yells, "Svina! Svina! I'm coming! Help him! Help him!" I grab him around his midriff and hold his arms tight. Then I see that he is once again calm. Weichert stands beside us and asks in a quiet voice, "What was the matter, Squirt? Did you have a bad dream? You know that Svina is with Meinhardt in his bunker." Then we go out into the frosty morning air. In the east, a narrow strip of light is announcing the dawn of a new day. Grommel is still a bit groggy and is searching for words to explain his dream, but what he says is lost in the infernal racket which is going on. It comes at us with such a force that there must be 1,000 devils in the air, and the earth around us is being consumed like a boiling hell. Before we rush back into the bunker, Vilka, who is standing guard outside, comes dashing over and falls to the ground right in front of us. We look at each other with disturbed white faces. Nobody says a word, but fear is obvious in every wrinkle of our skin. Our eyes gleam feverishly. Hell is fuming. Fire and glowing steel fall from the sky all around us. If we didn't know that the devastating shellfire was coming from the Soviets, we could be forgiven for thinking that here, on the 13th of December, the end of the world had begun. I can't stand it in the bunker anymore. I want to see this hell in which we will all perish. When I raise my head just a little above the edge of the bunker, I am paralysed with fear. The surface of the ground is dancing all the way up to the hillock in a hellish turmoil. Not a single square foot seems to be still. Fountains of earth mixed with cold snow and glowing splinters of metal churn over the area, being peppered with shell fragments. Nobody, but nobody, could take even a couple of steps without being caught up in this cauldron. The bursting thunderous noise and the screaming in the air are so loud that we can no longer make ourselves heard. On top of our bunker there are already a number of shallow craters caused by mortar fire, Stalinorgel, and light infantry weapons. But so far the roof, which we only reinforced 2 days ago, has held up. The hellish inferno ebbs somewhat after about half an hour, but it seems to us like an eternity. The communication trench and our position have been almost filled. It's a wonder we're still alive. What does the enemy have in mind now? We know that this crazy shelling can only be preparatory to an attack, but the enemy is still hidden by the morning mist. Somebody calls out my name. Then we see Varias. He comes rushing with long strides between the mortar explosions and falls almost to his knees in front of us. He is so out of breath that he can't speak straight away. His dirty face is sweaty and caked, but where we can see his skin, he is white as a sheet. Then he shrieks.
Turing's bunker has been hit again. Mein Hart, Svina, and the rest have been killed. The chap on the outside is only slightly wounded, and I have already bandaged him up. But Zeidel and two others have also been hit. I need more bandages so I can attend to them.
Weichert presses two packs of bandages into his hand, and he dashes back, zigzagging to avoid the incoming mortar rounds. The deaths of Mein Hart and Svina hit us heavily. My tears are caused not only by the acrid powder fumes. Fright increasingly grips me. My throat is parched, and I feel as if I am being strangled. I follow Varias with my eyes, and see that he jumps into the trench unharmed. Then Vilka yells hysterically,
"Tanks are coming! In great masses! Swarms of them!"
His last words are drowned out by the noise of the explosions from the shells the tanks are firing at us. Then I see them too. First, it's like a wall of fire advancing on us. Then a horde of brown beetles slowly approaches across the white steppe. A tank attack! Weichert hurriedly counts 50, but there must be more. So this is what the Soviets have prepared. A colossal tank attack against our desolate, poorly equipped outpost here, which has been holding him back and has inflicted far too many losses on him for far too long. Belching a threatening ripple of fire, the T-34s advance parallel with the railway line towards the village. Within the next quarter of an hour they will have reached it and will be able to roll up or cut off our position from the rear. We know that our time here has run out, and that the time of terror without end, the terrible end, has come. The question is there still a chance for us to escape this fate? We are standing in the protection of the bunker and are staring with sweaty faces now at the oncoming tanks, now at the fiery explosions on the churned-up field, up towards the safety of the hillock. A number of men near the hillock are now jumping out of their trenches and running up towards its protection. They want to reach the village before the tanks do, so that they can then escape over the frozen River Don. The sappers have also left their positions and are running towards the hillock. More and more men do likewise. They are running through a rain of shellfire and splinters. The further they have to run, the less chance they have of making it alive. The ground in between is littered with weapons, coats, equipment and other items, discarded so the men can run faster. Many of them are struck down and remain lying on the ground. Others manage to get up again and run on, bleeding. What should we do? Grommel and Vilka run like caged animals into and out of the bunker. Weichert ducks down beside me, ready to run. But he has still not decided. He points at two figures jumping out of the trench and now bounding through the deadly fire towards safety. I recognize the tall Varias and also Zeidel, who has a bandage around his head. Zeidel falls but springs up again and carries on. Vilka excitedly indicates to us that the first tanks have already reached the village. What should we do? Rush after the pair of them? We are furthest from the hillock, and if we are lucky enough to reach it, what awaits us behind it? Obviously we can't stay here in the bunker. That means death or imprisonment. Then, rather death. To be taken prisoner by the Soviets? That I would never live through.
They have all gone, yells Vilka, surprised and agitated.
No, not all of them yet. There are still some in that position there, replies Weichert. But Vilka has already taken off his webbing and is running into the seething cauldron. I can see him throwing away his heavy overcoat as he runs along. Then I lift Weichert and Grommel up over the edge of the trench. They have already stripped off all unnecessary baggage and are running for their lives. Now it's my turn. Am I the last one? No, I can still see a couple of men waiting.
What for? There are but two possibilities, run or stay. It calls for just as much daring to stay in the bunker and wait for the Soviets as it does to run through the explosions.
What a perfect soldier I am. Instead of freeing myself of all extraneous weight, I want to take along my belt and all my equipment. As I run, I notice very quickly that I am not getting away fast enough. So as I run, I tear off my overcoat and loosen my belt. The whole lot falls to the ground, and I keep only my .08 pistol in my hand. I dash over the shell craters and stumble over the items which the fleeing soldiers have discarded. All around me, grenades and shells are bursting. It is a run for life or death. Many have not made it to the hillock. They are lying silently or moaning on the ground. Others are calling for help. How can I help them? I could be lying there beside them any moment. The fear of death or a serious injury blanks out every other thought, and I see only the chance of saving my own skin. As I reach the hillock and disappear behind it, coughing and drenched in sweat, I have long since lost sight of my friends. I stumble over a dead body and fall in the snow, which here is still white and almost virgin. The body I have just stumbled over is that of Unteroffizier Schwarz, lying in a pool of blood from several wounds. Judging from the colour in his face, he can only recently have died. Then I see a new danger in front of me. Several T-34s have turned in front of the village and are now blocking the path of the escaping soldiers. They are driving several men before them, and the latter are running for their lives, trying to escape by zigzagging like rabbits. But the tanks are firing with their machine guns. Some of the men fall and are ground up by the tank tracks. I have to get through! It hammers away in my head. I have to stay in the blind spot of the tank. In spite of this, the bullets spray around my head, and then I sense a hit against the left side of my chest. Am I wounded? I don't feel anything which slows me down or weakens me, so I continue in my headlong rush. Suddenly, Vilka is beside me. He buckles at the knees and coughs. Shit! I can't go on! It's murderous! I grab him by the arm and pull him up, but after a couple of paces his legs give out again. Has he been hit? Horrified, I see a T-34 tank bearing down on us. With my last ounce of strength, I jump aside, but Vilka can no longer get up. The tank track is already over his body, and his terrified yell is swallowed up by the gunfire of the T-34. It never noticed the human being it just ran over. The tank is now firing at individual soldiers. Nothing restrains me anymore. I run and run until my lungs wheeze like a pair of old bellows. Finally, I reach the railings and vault over them. I fall down on some hard ground on the other side. For a moment, I remain lying there. The sweat is running down my forehead into my eyes. When I wipe my forehead with the back of my hand, it is bloody, but it is only a small graze from falling on the stone. Then I notice a ruined hut. That would give me some cover. I must get over there. And with a couple of strides, I make it. The broken-down door lies on the floor. Too late do I discover that lurking behind the remains of a wall is a T-34, its turret hatch open. A thunderous shot almost bursts my eardrums. Suddenly, a Soviet soldier jumps over the remains of the wall into the house and becomes glued to the spot. We are both surprised and stare at each other. He is unarmed, and I am holding my .08 pistol in my hand, aimed at him. The Russian is young, just like me, and is staring with concern at my pistol. If he attacks me, I will shoot. But he doesn't move. He just stands there and lets his hands fall to his sides. Slowly, I move backwards, until my back hits a beam. Then I turn and run away to the protection of some bushes close to the riverbank. There I meet up with a group of soldiers who, like me, are completely exhausted, and who, after a short pause to catch their breath, throw themselves onto the snow-covered ice of the Don. Under the terrifying machine gun and heavy fire from the many tanks which have assembled at the riverbank, they are trying to make it across the river to the safety of the other side, joining the ranks of all the other German soldiers who, in a sheer state of panic, are now engaged in a life-or-death struggle. In order to avoid falling into the hands of a merciless enemy, they choose to take the lesser risk of running over the deadly ice, which minutes earlier stretched away peacefully. I also clutch at this straw of hope and race off. The ice is too thin for the tanks, which therefore line themselves up on the high ground along the banks and fire at us as if at a shooting range. The shells explode without let-up. Men are falling onto the snow left and right. The white covering is now colouring itself blood red. The dead are lying in heaps, and the wounded are groaning and calling for help. In many places the ice has cracked open from the shell fire, and fountains of water are erupting high into the air. Many of the bodies lying on the snow disappear into the gurgling water as the ice breaks up. I run, stumbling over dead and wounded, hearing only explosions and aware that the snow is becoming stained red with blood. Then, finally, I reach the safety of the other bank. There aren't many of us who can manage to reach the far riverbank and seek the protection of the birch forest there. But even here we are not safe. The tank shells are exploding in the treetops, and splinters and branches are constantly raining down. Many who thought they were safe here have been injured. There are lots of bunkers in the forest. As we are running past one, an Unteroffizier waves us in. I stumble through the entrance and need some minutes before I can breathe normally again and talk. I send a thank you prayer to heaven, grateful that I've been able to survive the death run across the Don. The bunkers are in surprisingly good condition, clean and all professionally constructed with birch trunks of the same length. They must have been built to last. But who knows how long they have been standing empty? One soldier reckons that they were occupied by an artillery unit at one time. He has seen the prepared artillery positions on the banks of the Don. I should think that it's possible to hold out here for some time. The Unteroffizier offers me a cigarette. When I reach into my left breast pocket to take out my lighter, my fingers grip a piece of iron, deformed by a bullet or a splinter. The material is broken, and my fingers run through it. I can smell the gas which has leaked out in my uniform. Now I remember the hit I felt in the left side of my chest as I reached the hillock. The solid lighter that Stabsgefreiter Graller gave me in Stalingrad probably saved my life. I wonder what became of him and the others. But this is not the time to reminisce. We have to go on. One soldier, among the last to make it through the terrible ordeal on the Don, splutters that enemy infantry with mortar units are coming over the ice and will soon be here. We can't hold them up. We have no weapons. The Unteroffizier hasn't even got his submachine gun, and I am the only one who still has a pistol. We follow the Unteroffizier, who runs ahead of us through the forest underbrush. Terror remains deep in the bones of us all. Overhead, we can hear the mortar rounds exploding in the treetops, raining splinters down upon us. Our helmets would have come in handy now, but we threw them away because they hindered us during our headlong rush to get away. At the edge of the forest, we emerge onto the snow-covered steppe. An icy wind drives the powdery snow into small mounds, which then form into drifts. My body is slowly recovering. The sweat on my skin is slowly drying up. But now I begin to freeze. The same is happening to the others. Collars are pulled up, and those who still have caps are pulling the flaps down over their ears. We seek cover from the icy wind in Arachel, where we find another group of exhausted soldiers who belonged to our unit. They have dug themselves holes in the snow to protect themselves from the icy wind. In one of these holes, to my great delight, I come across my friends Varias and Grommel. They both made it safely over the Don, but now they are really freezing. Varias does not even have a cap on his head, while Grommel is sitting in the snow hole, shivering. Cold can be deadly, particularly when the body is emaciated like ours. And there is not a house nor a barn to be seen, nowhere to crawl for some warmth. So we must go on until we can find some of our own men. But where are they? Have they gone so far south that we won't be able to find them? Walking and pressing against the wind are very tiresome, although the exercise does keep the bones moving. Some of the wounded soldiers can't make it any further. We rest in the next rachel and dig holes in the snow. But to stay there too long will give us frostbite, so I force myself to get out and run up and down from time to time, so that the stiffness in my body loosens. 14th of December. In the early hours of the morning, we are driven from the Rachel by heavy fire. The Soviets have noticed us and have trained their mortars on us. We run like frightened chickens. The biting wind whips cold snowflakes into our hot faces, immediately converting the snow into small streams of water which freeze solid into small clumps hanging from the stubble on our unshaven faces. When we regroup, we hear fire being exchanged to the right. Then German soldiers suddenly appear, running towards us out of the mass of whirling snow, calling out that the Russians are right behind them. We join them and run along together. Behind us, a Russian machine gun is rattling away and rifle shots snap. One man turns around and yells like crazy. He holds his rifle in front of him and blazes away at the enemy, but after a few paces he falls, hit to the snow. One more has lost the battle. We race on. The shooting behind us increases. Amongst the firing, we hear the Soviets in their forward charge yelling. Their hurrahs are right behind us and make us run even faster. Suddenly, three tanks appear in front of us, German assault guns. They wait until we have passed them, then open fire. The cries and the firing behind us are silenced. The assault guns move slowly forward and fire at maximum rate. Then we suddenly find ourselves in the middle of a combat unit, moving forward with the tanks in a counterattack to throw the enemy back. But for how long? Following the counterattack, we join up with this combat force and return with them to their jump-off point. The Leutnant in charge decides to integrate our unit, about 30 men, into his one. The men are lying in the protection of a kolkhoz and some farm buildings. Even though we get something to eat after going without for 2 days, I still feel totally miserable. Or is this cowardice? After all, what can you expect from a soldier who has just passed through the scorching heat of hell and looks as though he has succumbed to the miseries there, like virtually all his friends and comrades have? Should he accept their deaths simply as the soldier's fate without question and keep on fighting? Damn it! I would do it if we were launching an attack and had some chance of winning. But here we are, running scared. Is it cowardice when you no longer have anything in your hands with which you can defend yourself? This rabble, the one with which we three have ended up, has done nothing, God knows, to improve our will to fight. They're stragglers, like the ones who came over to us near Rychov, but their combat morale is so low that we are forever having to put up with them going on about how best they can get the hell out of it. We're told how the leaders have had to use their guns to keep the men obedient. They'd bolted once, before the enemy was even seen. Some even shot themselves in their arms or legs. They would hold a loaf of bread in front of the muzzle to make sure there would be no powder burns or singe marks. Those found out will be court-martialed and can expect to be executed. An Obergefreiter will be court-martialed because he is supposed to have deliberately allowed both his feet to get frozen. Before they brought him to the medics, he told us that following a Russian attack, he had saved himself by playing dead. In order to avoid being detected by the enemy, he had spent the entire night in a snowdrift. When another combat unit freed him the next morning during a counterattack, his feet were two blocks of ice. It was his tough luck that no one in this combat unit knew him. We are given a carbine and ammunition from our new unit. In addition, I'm able to get hold of a second-hand and originally white camouflage suit with a quilted jacket and trousers. There are no more helmets. The few houses are all full up. Our squad is led to a shed, which has gaps between each vertical plank in the walls, so large that the wind blows the ice-cold snowflakes through. We cover them as best we can with ground sheets. There is only wet straw to sleep on, but even this is better than camping outside in the icy steppe. The next morning we receive a hot liquid which is passed off as coffee, but at least it warms our insides. 15th of December. My spirits have hit rock bottom. We learn that a group of soldiers has actually disappeared with a truck, and we are now left with 3 assault guns and 2 trucks. It is said that the men who left belonged to a penal company before they came here. How rumours fly! We march off, always forward and somewhere in the direction of the front. The snow is falling more heavily, and soon we can only see a white surface in front of us, interrupted only by the occasional bush. Where are the positions supposed to be? If they do exist, they must have been covered by the snow. The houses behind us have long since disappeared behind the curtains of snow, and the Feldwebel seems to be ill at ease in this winter wasteland. He decides to halt in front of a wide rachel. Suddenly, coming from somewhere or other, rifle shots can be heard. Out of the whirling snow, several figures appear and run with us into the rachel. They are German soldiers fleeing from the enemy. They tell us that they've been lost in the snowy waste since yesterday, and only by good fortune have been able to get away from the Soviets, who seem to be everywhere. They belonged to a combat group that was in position on the frozen River Chir, and which yesterday was overrun by a pack of T-34 tanks with mounted infantry. The survivors had bolted, and are now wandering around somewhere in the steppe. One soldier was shot during the last exchange of fire. He could not run any further, as he had fallen asleep last night, and both his legs had frozen. The Soviets in front of us were working on getting their four mortars ready to fire. The Feldwebel is undecided. He sends a runner back to request that the three assault guns be moved up. As soon as they get here, we'll attack the mortar position. We wait, and because of the cold, we dig ourselves into the snow. For a while, we are warm because of the recent movement, but as the wind increases, it whistles through our clothing to our very bones, causing them to tremble. Varias wraps his hands intermittently on his calves, arms, and shoulders. The winter coat with which he was issued is much too short, and his legs are stuck into a couple of slit-open felt boots that were removed from a dead soldier. Grommel, too, wears second-hand felt boots, and his coat is only a thin, ragged army type. But he says that he has a warm, and probably lice-infested, lamb's wool vest underneath, which another soldier tried on in the kolkhoz and found to be too tight. On his head he wears a Russian fur cap, given to him by one of the assault gun crewmen. He therefore looks like a Russian, and some of our men are already calling him Ivan. With my camouflage outfit, I am definitely the best off. But nevertheless, I still freeze horribly here in this bloody country, where Napoleon and his entire army perished. Everything I have read about this episode in the history books I am now experiencing for myself. I shudder when I think about being wounded here in this snowy wasteland, and lying helplessly until my body slowly turns into a lump of ice. Why don't the assault guns come? We wait and wait, and then, too late. We hear the mortar shells rushing in. In spite of the fact that they hit the ground some distance away, splinters do zip through the air and pass close to our heads. It doesn't particularly upset us. We're used to much worse. I even decide to stand up so that I can keep my feet moving. Then a shell explodes on the slope across from us. We can see the splinters fizzing in the snow. A soldier calls out, and I feel a slight pain underneath my left kneecap. They are calling for the medic who is in our group. He is taking care of the wounded man, whose thigh has been torn open by a splinter, and who as a result is bleeding heavily. He is an Obergefreiter, wearing the blue uniform of a Luftwaffe field division. He came to this group with three others when his own unit was decimated. After the medic has taken care of the man, I show him the place where I felt a hit. Directly under my kneecap there is a small hole, about the size of a pea. It doesn't hurt, and I can move my leg okay, but a thin trickle of blood, almost black in colour, is running down my shin. The medic attaches a plaster. "Too bad," he says, almost apologetically, and shrugs his shoulders. I know what he means. He is trying to tell me that unfortunately it does not qualify me for a Heimatschuss. I feel the disappointment. A hope has been dashed. And then I think how quickly human feelings and attitudes can change. It is only a matter of weeks since I was dreaming of glory and heroism, and was so full of elan that I was almost bursting. Now I long for a Heimatschuss, because it appears to me to be the only way that I can, with any sort of honour, say goodbye to this soul-destroying environment, and, for at least a few weeks, get away from this awful country and its gruesome winter. Is it cowardice to think like this, to start comparing our war here with trying to stop a full-blown avalanche merely by using human bodies? With human beings who, full of despair and freezing to death, shiver in icy holes in the snow, and each morning thank God that their bones have not frozen solid because they are still needed to help you get away to safety from the attacking enemy. I don't think that this rabble of soldiers, thrown together and without proper heavy weapons, will be able to hold back the Russians here on the Don and Chir this winter. Anyone who can escape from the situation with just an injury really can talk about his luck. But thinking that you might fall into this category isn't being realistic. It's a dream. And when does a dream ever come true? The path of a splinter or bullet does not conform to the wishes of the ordinary soldier. Splinters and bullets are hard, hot, and nasty. They search out life hiding in dirty rags and try to extinguish it with one blow. The wind gets stronger. It howls through the Rachel and swirls around us in our hole in the snow. It drives the powdery snow into our faces and melts on the warm skin. When I move my left leg, I can feel a painful pulling sensation and a slight swelling. Late in the afternoon, the three assault guns arrive. Because of the heavy driving snow, they want to wait until they attack. But the enemy preempts us. For the Soviets, this is attack weather. We first notice them as they draw close to our Rachel. The assault guns are using anti-personnel shells. We fire blindly into the snowy haze. The flakes drive into us, gluing up our faces and our eyes. Then the phantom disappears. We have hardly put down any counterfire.
It was only a reconnaissance squad, says a Gefreiter who belongs to the Feldwebel's circle.
He tells us that the enemy attacked here yesterday morning, and that a number of dead soldiers are lying covered up by the recent snow. Then we hear a firefight on one of our flanks. The assault guns are ordered to return to the kolkhoz. How will things develop now? We stay in our snow holes and wait. I want to stand up again, but find that I can't. It's as though I have a wooden leg. The knee is completely stiff. If the enemy attacks now, I'm afraid I'm finished. I'm not able to walk, let alone run. Oh, no. In my anxiety, I call for the medic. He taps my swollen knee, which has come up like a balloon. The skin is stretched taut, as if it has been brushed with dope, and is dark blue.
Hemorrhage, says the medic.
The massive internal bleeding came about because the little hole was stopped up with the plaster, and the blood could not therefore escape, but instead built up inside my leg.
I can't do anything with it. The leg has to be placed in a cast and immobilized. But before the medics in Nizhnichirskaya put your leg in a cast, you should show the splinter to a doctor, because otherwise it could easily cause blood poisoning.
Nizhnichirskaya? How do I get there? I ask, surprised, but also happy that I now perhaps can get out of this mess. The medic shrugs his shoulders.
I don't know that either.
But I can't walk. Then I feel a tension in my guts, which I always feel when anxiety suddenly overtakes me.
I know, nods the medic. I've also got the wounded Obergefreiter. I wanted to send him along with the assault guns, but they had no room for a stretcher case.
Damn! Now I've got the opportunity to get away from here, and I'm not able to. How unlucky can you get? But I again get a glimmer of hope as the medic returns and tells me that we are to stay here in the Rachel tonight and will receive our provisions here. Then we should be able to return to the kolkhoz with the supply vehicle. When that supply vehicle is due, he doesn't know. We'll just have to wait. Well, what does that mean? How long? 2 or 3 hours? It really doesn't matter, because I know that I'll soon be on my way to safety, but I'm not there yet. I spend the next few hours in two minds. I can't yet believe that I'll be able to get out of here, out of this snowbound steppe, which has no feelings for anybody, and which only intensifies my fear of being wounded or suffering a terrible death through freezing. But the next enemy attack, which we cannot possibly withstand, could alter everything. I can't walk, and I'd have to stay here in this lousy hole in the snow and wait for the end. I can only pray that it won't happen. My prayers must have been heard, because the supply truck comes earlier than expected. He also brings orders for the entire force to depart immediately, as the enemy is reported to have already broken through the defences on the flank of the kolkhoz. The truck driver is in a hurry to return. Varyas and Gromel carry me to the truck. The Obergefreiter's three friends do the same for him. We lie on the bare truck bed, leaning our backs on the sides. The Obergefreiter is in great pain. He groans as he says his goodbyes to his friends. The thought that Varyas and Gromel will remain here puts a damper on my excitement to be getting out of here. Something wells up in my throat, further and further until my eyes water. It's as if I'm abandoning them. We three were, among the many unknown and foreign soldiers, like brothers. We stuck together through thick and thin and helped each other whenever we could. As they give me their hand in farewell, Grommel wipes his eyes with his arm, and Varias tries to hide his feelings by overplaying his mood, boldly announcing,
"Don't forget to say hello to the blonde waitress in the Tivoli. Tell her that I'll soon be there to arrange a date with her."
I force myself to laugh and assure him that I will tell her. Then the truck drives off into the darkness. In spite of the truck's tarpaulin, the wind blows from all sides, chilling me through to the marrow. The truck follows the tracks which the assault guns have made. Every time the vehicle goes over a bump, we feel the truck bed shake. The Obergefreiter groans softly. He appears to be in considerable pain. Apart from putting on a bandage, the medic was unable to do anything for him. He feels in his pocket and gives me an Activa. That's what we call a ready-made cigarette you get in a packet, as opposed to one you roll yourself. I'm thankful, for I've got only a couple of flakes of coarse, curly-cut tobacco for my pipe left in my pouch. We inhale the smoke in silence. The truck jolts and makes a sharp turn. I can feel my knee. The wounded man suppresses a cry of pain and groans, "Damn and shit! First you wait day and night for a Heimatschuss, and then everything changes. You can't even be happy about it, because you have to slink away from your mates. Which of those poor devils will ever see home again?" It's a good thing he can't see my face in the dark, nor taste the bitterness I've felt in my throat ever since we left. Not even the sharp flavour of the tobacco can drive away this sensation. As we come to the settlement by the kolkhoz, there is a general atmosphere of breaking camp. They have been waiting for the truck. Away to the west, we can hear intermittent tank fire. An officer allows some clothing to be packed on the truck. An Unteroffizier and a couple of men sit down among the packages. One of them has a headband. I can't see his face in the darkness, but I recognize him by his voice. "Kurzeidel!" I call out, surprised and delighted. It is him. We have quite a lot to tell each other, the death run over the frozen Don and everything thereafter. He tells me that he was waiting with the others at the riverbank for too long. When he did finally start running, the first Russians were right behind him. By then, the tanks had eased off. He managed to get away from the Russians with three others and later ran into another group of stragglers who were being chased by the Russians. They didn't come across this larger combat unit until today. I point to his headband. Zeidel tells me that it's just a small wound which has almost completely healed, but because he hasn't got a cap, he has left the bandage on to help keep his head warm. He does not belong to the fortunate ones with Heimatschüsse, but must remain here and continue to look after himself. We haven't seen each other since that time. By the time I was being loaded into an ambulance with many other wounded, just before we got to Nizhnechirskaya, Zeidel had jumped off the truck with the others. Only later, when I was with the convalescent company, did I learn that he had been killed. The ambulance pulls up in front of a large building. The slightly wounded get out, while I and two others are carried in on stretchers. In the room it smells of ether and carbolic. Everywhere there are wounded lying around. Some of them are groaning. From outside comes the sound of commands being given. Tractors and tanks rumble by. I can hear artillery fire in the distance. I am no longer concerned about all this. I feel safe here. But am I really safe here? One chap tells me that he was wounded just 2 hours ago, not far from here, up north. The Soviets are attacking all the time, and according to him, we won't be able to hold them back for very long. In spite of this, I sleep quite well on the straw bed because I am dog-tired. The unaccustomed heat in the room and the knowledge that I don't have to go out tonight have relaxed my body. 16th of December. As two medics lift me up on a stretcher, I rise sleepily and immediately fall back on the stretcher with a groan. For the first time, I feel a really stinging pain in my knee. They bring me into a well-lit room. Someone is just about to collect together some amputated, blood-soaked body parts in a ground sheet. Later, another man comes over to me, dressed in a blood-stained rubber apron. The sergeant accompanying him addresses him as Herr Oberstabsarzt. He cuts my left trouser leg with a pair of scissors, as well as my two pairs of long johns. He examines my knee. My leg is dark blue from my thigh all the way down to the calf, and as thick as an inflated inner tube. He gives me an injection and tells an assistant to put my leg in a splint and cover it in a plaster cast.
"There is nothing more we can do," he says, before he moves on to the next patient.
The medic cuts off the rest of my trousers and underwear all the way up to my thigh, lays the leg in a splint, and covers it expertly with the wetted plaster of Paris bandages. The gypsum sets quickly. After I receive a wound receipt with the appropriate date stamped on it, duly fastened to my chest, I am transferred into a special room where other patients in care are resting. From some of the wounded, I learn that those who can be moved will be transferred to Marozovskaya, where there is a larger medical assembly station. A day later, I am again loaded into an ambulance. Chapter 6. A Temporary Lull. December the 17th. The ambulance frequently has to take detours en route to Marozovskaya. In the north, the Soviets are said to have broken through another front line, this one manned by the Italians. They are reportedly on their way south. Gunfire can still be heard in the distance. I am not particularly concerned, as I'm not in action, and I consider my surroundings only from the viewpoint of someone who is bedridden. If no one disturbs me, I'll be asleep either on the ambulance or later on in Marozovskaya. I'm catching up on the sleep I missed out on over the last several weeks. Because my leg, in its cast, doesn't need any particular medical attention, I'm only woken up when they serve me my meals or when I have to take a tablet. 18th of December. I don't count the days anymore, so I don't know how long I've been in Marozovskaya in this blissful sleep when I'm suddenly rattled by high fever. I am given several injections, and I hazily seem to understand that I am being loaded into an ambulance train together with several other wounded. The fever increases, and terrible pictures form in front of my eyes, causing me to cry out, whimper, and shudder. Slowly my surroundings come into focus, and I recognize that I am lying on the top of a two-tiered white bed in an ambulance train. A young blonde nurse with a red cross on her cap is standing next to my bed and is softly singing Christmas carols. Some of the wounded are accompanying her in their raw voices. The rhythm of the wheels is changing and is being converted into a hard, threatening hammering. The sound reverberates painfully in my head. I close my eyes and press my forehead onto the frosty window. It does not cool me down, but instead causes the frost patterns on the window to melt. A cool hand is laid across my hot temple, wet with perspiration, and a soft voice says a few calming words. As if coming through a veil, I recognize the young nurse. She gives me two tablets and helps me to swallow them. Thereafter, I fall asleep exhausted, but I don't have any dreams. 26th of December. During the afternoon of the second day of Christmas, I am once more able to think straight. On my bed are my Christmas presents, still unopened. I'm surprised at the generous contents of the gifts. They are the sorts of things which we for months had to do without. Plenty of cigarettes are included. I light one and discover that it tastes good. This is a sign that I am more myself again. But it is still a while before I can really understand where I am, and that I have also survived the blood poisoning which the medic back at the kolkhoz told me I could expect. My neighbour, who lies in the top bunk across the aisle from me, has just awoken and greets me with a friendly remark.
"Ah, just risen from the dead. I'm glad you're finally awake, my friend."
I smile at him and see that he is holding his right arm out like a wing. Later, I learn that the soldiers call it a shtuka, because the arm is held in a track, in plaster, and at an angle which resembles that of the wings of a shtuka dive bomber. This treatment is generally used when the arm has suffered a break caused by a gunshot wound. I assume my new friend has such a break. He tells me that we stopped in Stalino yesterday, and that we offloaded some slightly wounded soldiers. Only the seriously wounded and fever-stricken were left in the beds. The empty beds are, however, already filled up again.
"We are now travelling homewards," he tells me happily, "over Krakow to Schlesien, and from there I will soon be home."
"Where is home?" I ask him.
"In Marienbad, in Sudetenland," he tells me with obvious pride.
Then he describes the place for me, making it sound as if it were the most beautiful speck of dirt in the world, and I feel an urge to pay a visit sometime. I have no idea that at the close of the war I would actually be drawn to this idyllic health resort. This conversation with my bunkmate undoubtedly influenced my ending up in a military hospital there, after my sixth and last injury.
"Where were you wounded?" I ask.
"In Stalingrad, on the 10th of December," he says, and I can see how his face twitches.
The word Stalingrad suddenly hangs heavily in the room. Most of the wounded come from Stalingrad, or, like me, from the edge of the Don or Chir pocket.
"Was really just lucky to get out of there. Now it's supposed to be bloody difficult."
"Why's that?" I ask, as I've not heard anything about the situation there for days.
"Because the prospects for those left in the pocket have now become very black," remarks another patient lying in a bunk somewhere beneath us. "The last hope, that Hort with his tanks was going to break through the pocket, has now gone up in smoke as well. They need him elsewhere."
Others now decide to get involved. They complain bitterly about the top brass. One says angrily that they should all go to hell. No one disagrees, because everyone senses that he didn't say this without good reason. He and some of the others were in the pocket themselves, and experienced firsthand how they were given hope and had promises made to them that they would be got out. That is, until it was too late, and they realized that the Sixth Army in Stalingrad was in fact to be sacrificed. Only a very small number of them had the good fortune to be flown out in the nick of time because of their injuries. This is now supposed to be pretty nearly impossible, they say. One soldier, with a bandage round his head, and who can only see out of one eye, ridicules the latest army radio report, which plays down the disaster in Stalingrad, and refers to the defeat of the Sixth Army in a highly stylized propaganda report about the willingness of the German soldier to make a heroic stand. Not everyone is as strong, and many are unable to hide even their everyday fears. The chap under my bunk must come into this category, because ever since I woke up he has been whimpering non-stop. Out of curiosity, I lean over the edge of the bunk and see that his left arm and shoulder are bound into a sort of Stuka cast. I can't recognize his face. His whimpering is incessant, and it never ends. It really gets on everyone's nerves. In particular, it disturbs the seriously wounded men who are trying to get some sleep. Finally, it gets too much for the soldier with the headband and one eye. He turns to the whimperer and angrily tells him off.
"For God's sake, stop that bloody whimpering! You're driving us all mad with your constant groaning!"
The fellow does not react in the least. On the contrary, he seems to get worse. We manage to get rid of him in Krakow when he is offloaded with some other men. 28th of December. As soon as the beds have been freshly made up, others are carried in. The following day I arrive at my destination. I am offloaded in Bad Salzbrunn near Hirschberg at the foot of the Riesengebirge. I say my goodbyes to my bunkmates, who are being taken further on. 29th of December to the 20th of January, 1943. After we are led through the delousing chamber, we are laid on clean beds in a newly established military hospital. The rest of my stay here passed so quietly and uneventfully that I hardly have any memory of it. It went out of sight about as fast as the overripe Hartz cheese that they placed in our dish on the nightstand as our ration every other day. My notes were reduced to comments about the head doctor with the pointed head and protruding frog eyes. After cutting up my plaster cast, he told me he suspected me of shirking my duty and pretending to be wounded. Old Frog Eyes even asked me how come I had the leg placed in a cast. He messed around with my louse-bitten and dirty leg for a long time, and brusquely ordered me to stand up and not to pretend to be wounded. He even threatened to write a report to the court-martial, and growled something about malingering, cowardice in the face of the enemy, and so on. But it was very odd. Even I couldn't find any traces of my wound, and I couldn't locate the exact point where the splinter had entered my leg. The pea-sized light red scar could just as easily have been taken for one of the many abrasions caused by the lice and which covered the entire leg. The X-ray photographs finally exonerated me. I watched how the frog-eyed military doctor stared at the clearly visible jagged splinter in total disbelief, looking as though his goggle eyes would pop out of his head at any moment. A head doctor had absolutely no need to apologize to a mere lancer, but he mumbled something about the fact that there were always some among the wounded who would deliberately injure themselves, or think up all sorts of other tricks to get themselves out of frontline duty. During the ensuing therapy, I discover that the splinter doesn't cause me any problems, so I consider it to have been a lucky Heimatschuss, and one which, with God's help, saved me from an awful fate. Here in the hospital, we learned that supplies for Stalingrad could no longer be got through by air, neither could the wounded be flown out. Thus, the fate of the Sixth Army was as good as sealed. We just could not grasp the fact that there really was no way of bringing out the men Adolf Hitler had stationed there to create Fortress Stalingrad. We wondered whether we would ever find out how and why this catastrophe came about in the first place. 21st of January. I am discharged from the hospital and get my convalescent leave. I'm going home at last. But inside, I'm not as free and unencumbered as before. I can't wipe away what I have experienced with a mere wave of the hand. My skin is simply not thick enough. As I walk through the streets of our village, I am barely noticed. Well, why should I be? There are soldiers all over the place, and there are many among them that I don't know. An ordinary soldier with a bronze wound badge is too unobtrusive to be of interest. You get one even for a small splinter under the knee. It's only a few acquaintances who ask about frontline duty. When I tell them about it, they become curious, but not one of them believes what I say. The truth would devastate them, because as far as they are concerned, German soldiers conform to what they hear every day in the army reports. They are heroes who only storm forward. If they fall, it is only during an attack or through defending. They never give up an inch of ground unless for tactical reasons they are given orders to fall back. Just look at Stalingrad. There's the proof. The problem with leave is that it passes far too quickly. Now I have to return to the camp at Insterburg, first to the convalescent company. 14th of February. I have arrived at Insterburg. On the way to the orderly room, I run into the relaxed atmosphere of the company in the shape of several inebriated soldiers. They welcome me as a newcomer with a "Hello!" although we don't actually know each other. The Obergefreiter, or Head Snorter, as he is called here, slaps me on the shoulder and offers me a slug of juniper brandy, which I down while holding my breath. As I leave the orderly room where I reported in, I accidentally bump into a large aluminium urn filled with coffee that a soldier is carrying. The boiling hot liquid splashes over my neat leave uniform. I stare angrily at the steaming wet spot on my trousers, while the man who was carrying it yells at me, "You silly sod! Are you blind?" I am absolutely dumbfounded. The ever-hungry Hans Weichert is standing in front of me, large as life. I haven't seen him since Richoff, and I'd felt certain he was either missing or dead. Before I can say anything, he slaps me on the shoulder.
"Welcome to the land of the living," he says.
I can still remember him as a skeleton when on the 13th of December he leapt up and ran out in front of me over the hill under violent tank fire. I learn how Varias and Weichert are still on convalescent leave, having just left hospital. They both begin their leave tomorrow. We have a lot to catch up on, but it is too noisy here, and we look for a table in the canteen. In the canteen, Varias, as if by magic, produces a bottle of East Prussian Bear Catcher. It is a tasty drink made from honey and alcohol, like a liqueur, which I prefer to the unpleasant juniper brandy.
"Where do you think I got that from?" he asks, suppressing a grin in his freckled face. "I suspect you will tell me in a minute."
"I got it from the blonde waitress in the Tivoli," he smiles proudly.
I'm surprised.
"Then I assume that I don't need to pass on your regards like you asked me to when I was injured. And I reckon you will not want to buy me a round, like you promised."
"No, no! What do you take me for? What Helmut Varias promises, he delivers."
The tall Varias taps himself on the chest.
"But first, you must allow me to go on leave."
We change the subject and talk about our experiences. I go first and explain about my wound and about the incident with old Frog Eyes, the doctor in the military hospital. Then Vikert relates how, after a terrible dash across the Don with two others, he got lost in the snow haze, and first